Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here back on the program Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is this program we've been doing for a long time now, once a month, generally speaking, on a Monday, to give people the chance to ask questions about home maintenance. And if you got a problem, you can give us a call. We already have somebody who is standing by ready to go, but I'll give that number. Obviously, that person knows the number, but I better give the number. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's always great to be here.
Why don't we go ahead and do this call? And I know one of the things that you said it'd be a good thing to talk about is air conditioning. Well, we'll put that on hold for just a second and get to this first caller. In St. Joe, line number one. Right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
What with the energy costs rising and everybody being more concerned about energy efficiency, I wondered, is it worth the cost and effort to install insulation between the roof rafters with about 10 inches of insulation under the attic floor? I already have that under the attic floor. Just wondered if I need to go further.
No, actually, I would not recommend putting any insulation in the rafter area. What that does was to create an area where we don't get ventilation next to our roof sheathing, and our roof sheathing being the coldest spot on the house, since it is above all the insulation, you can actually get condensation in that area. Your attic area really should have quite a bit of ventilation. Once you've got your 10 to 12 inches insulation in your attic floor, the heat loss through the attic is minimal.
Super. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Then we'll go to Lafayette for another caller here. Line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. We need a new dehumidifier on the basement floor. And my question is, with such dehumidifiers, is it the same as with a power or the chiller dehumidifying on the air conditioning? That is, that you should size it fairly close to the need, and that a bigger, stronger dehumidifier is self-defeating.
Well, actually, no. The dehumidification process of the dehumidifier, what it's doing is it's running and taking humidity out of the house. Usually, they have a humidistat so that it shuts off at a certain range to keep your house in a comfort zone. How much central air conditioning do you run? Do you not run your air conditioner on a regular basis, or do you?
Oh, it runs pretty much.
Okay. You don't need one that's going to be too big, basically because it's not doing anything other than heating air and cooling air, so it's not helping you efficiently. All it's doing is taking the humidity out of the air so you are more comfortable in the house. A little experimentation that I did at my home was that during the air conditioning season, if I had a power dehumidifier running in the basement, I was actually more comfortable in the house at a higher setting. In my particular case, I could set the house at 80 degrees and be comfortable with the dehumidifier. When I turned the dehumidifier off, 80 degrees in the house was warm and felt clammy, so I had to turn the air conditioner down to about 78 degrees or so to help pull out that extra moisture. So a lot depends on how your air conditioner is sized as to how well it's controlling the humidity in the house.
Okay, but there's no advantage then or disadvantage to getting a dehumidifier for the floor that's stronger than it really needs to be.
No, it's not, because actually the dehumidifier is going to help regulate the overall humidity in the house, not just the basement. Most people feel that the basement is a little bit more damp than the rest of the house, but since water, once it evaporates, becomes a water vapor, vapor moves according to vapor pressure, and the vapor pressure will actually try and equalize throughout the house. The basement being a little bit cooler, that's the first place you'll find condensation if you've got excess humidity in the house. But if you're running your air conditioner, the dehumidifier is in the air conditioner, or the dehumidification process of the air conditioner is actually probably as efficient or more efficient than the dehumidifier you put in your basement. So that would be a supplemental thing, but it's not going to take a big unit because your air conditioner is going to do the most of the job for you.
Okay. Let me ask you, what does it mean when ice forms in large measure on the coils of the dehumidifier?
Basically, that's a common problem when the house is relatively cool. That's why dehumidifiers don't work real well in the wintertime. Basically, what the dehumidifier is, it's a refrigerator unit, and the coils are designed to get cold, and the water in the house condenses on it. usually not enough air moving past it, or you've got it in an area where things cool off, you're not getting any heat buildup. You know, if you put it in a far corner of a basement that's relatively cool anyway, and you close closet doors and such to where we're not getting any warm air back in there, we can get a little bit of ice. Some of the older ones, if they start losing a little bit of Freon, will tend to overcool, which will then ice over the coils. Also setting it for maximum dehumidification instead of letting it cycle so it runs all the time will tend to overcool the coils and block it up with ice.
Okay. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you. I have one that I run in also our basement, and I was wondering what was going on with it recently because it does run year-round, but it seemed that recently it was running and yet it wasn't squeezing much moisture out. And I guess I couldn't make up my mind whether there was actually a problem with it or the fact that, as the manual says, if the temperature is below 65 degrees, it's not going to operate at its maximum efficiency. Well, it's actually pretty cold in the basement. So, you know, between that and I also got a hygrometer, whatever that thing is, that, you know, it measures the humidity. And actually, humidity was fairly close to its trigger point. So I'm thinking, well, maybe that just means that there's not that much humidity in the air. It's not at its most efficient operating point. So, well, yeah, maybe it's actually not going to be squeezing much humidity out of the air.
That's pretty much exactly it, Dave. What we end up with is the humidity level in the wintertime, the outdoor humidity level is not as high. So our indoor humidity level is usually not as high unless we've got a moisture source, such as a damp crawl space or lack of vapor barrier or even on the scary side, a blocked chimney flue for a furnace or something like that, some combustion gases. So there's not usually as much excess humidity in the house so that the humidifier is not going to have to run or take as much moisture out to keep the humidity level comfortable.
How many years service would you expect to get out of a dehumidifier?
Well, they run a lot like an air conditioner, so usually 10 to 12 years. But again, like air conditioners, the newer ones are going to be a little bit more efficient than some of the older ones. So if you've got one that was handed down to you from way back when that you can't find a date on it, and it looks like it's been around since the beginning of the Mayflower here, you may want to consider getting a different one.
Okay. Well, we have another caller here. Our guest this morning, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's our monthly program on home maintenance issues. And if you have a question, you have a problem, give us a call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line 2, right here. Hello.
Good morning. I've got lots of questions. I'll just run through them. I'm thinking about putting up a gazebo, and I'd be interested to hear in what you had to say about gazebo kits and what kind of base you would put a gazebo on. We have a geothermal furnace, and we have an elaborate, which is, means I think just expensive, furnace filter that's got lots and lots and lots and lots of pleats, and I never quite know when to change that. And then we've got some sort of gutter helmet on, and the starlings are very happy nesting in the gutter, flying in under that gutter helmet at the ends, and I'm wondering if you have any suggestions about how to block that space up to keep those dang noisy birds out of there.
All right. Well, how about if I take those in reverse order?
Any way you like.
Let's start with the gutter. If there's a gap big enough for the birds to get in, a simple piece of hardware cloth or quarter-inch wire mesh over that should be more than enough to deter them.
Okay.
You're never going to get a gutter helmet to fit completely tight because then if you do, then, of course, water doesn't get into it.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you've got an end cap or something that's loose or it didn't extend to the end cap, a piece of hardware cloth or what they call a quarter-inch wire mesh would be fine.
Okay.
All right. Filter. Well, those pleated filters, they are very good filters. They will help filter things down as small as tree and grass pollens.
Oh,
but
wow.
Like cheese, they keep getting better with age until they get so good you have to basically throw it away because it got moldy.
That's
yes.
Your dad. That's one of your dad's jokes.
Yes, it is. Oh, well, where do you think I picked this up? It's difficult to tell occasionally. If the furnace starts cycling a lot, that's usually an indication that there's not enough airflow.
Mm-hmm.
If you notice that the air coming out is much warmer or much cooler than what it normally is, that's an indication of a lack of airflow.
Mm-hmm.
As a general rule, if you've got pets or something like that, I like to see those replaced about every 9 months. If your house is relatively clean without the long hair pets and things to help block it up, you can get by with once a year.
Okay, and can I, when I, it, it come, you know, you have to fit it in its little kind of case. When you look at it, and when we're out on the edge of town, you know, that you can see the gray, the brown kind of creeping up. Is there, if it's brown halfway up, is that okay? Can I keep using it?
Yes, you can. The filter, as it starts picking up a little bit of dust and dirt, just becomes a little bit more efficient. It's
right.
It's blocking up some of the holes, so it actually will filter out some finer particles. Air conditioning wise, it's pretty easy to check in the winter, in the summertime, mm-hmm. because you're looking for most units about a 12 to 15 degree temperature drop across the system. So if you had, a thermometer in the return air, mm-hmm. And you've got the house set at 75 degrees, and the air coming out is somewhere more than 15 degrees, so you'd be down in 60 or 58 or 60, then you're not getting enough air through the system, then it's probably time to change the filter.
Okay.
So that would be one indication. But, yeah, on those pleated filters, because they've got – I think it was something like 80 square feet is what I measured. I'm assuming you're talking about the standard Space Guard filter, just from the.
I don't know. It's a $50 filter, so I don't.
Yeah.
I'd like to change it as infrequently as I feel as I can. I don't know. We order it specially from the furnace guys.
Yeah.
So
usually we figure about once a year, unless you've got some extenuating circumstances.
Okay. Good. That sounds fine.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, and then how about
the gazebo? I want to know about the gazebo.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot the last one. The gazebo. All right. Well, a gazebo is let's face it, it's an outbuilding. There's several different styles. Most of them do require some type of post or something in the ground to help keep them from blowing wind from the wind blowing them over.
Yeah.
Once you've got your foundation set, whether they're like I say, most of them will have a post. There are a few of them out there that you pour a concrete footing on. You actually bolt it down to a footing.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of depends on the kit and the manufacturer. So they usually are pretty pretty explicit about how they want it attached or what kind of a surface they want it set on. From that standpoint,
it would be reasonable just to go by what they say, and they won't lead us astray.
Yeah, because there's so many different styles out there. There's a post style. There's a plate style. And there are different footings that you have to use for each one. So, yes, that's one of those things where we're going to have to defer to the engineer of the gazebo.
Of the gazebo. Anything to look for in you know, the kind of wood, what to look for in a kit? I mean, I have no sense of that at all. Redwood, cedar, what kind of sealer?
Well, of course, any type of pressure-treated lumber. You wouldn't have to worry about it rotting, but you want to put some UV protectant on it. The redwoods and the cedar type, they're a little fancier. You can put some oils on them to help them stay in good condition or looking like new.
Right.
Again, a clear repellent. But they have natural inhibitors to deterioration. The oils that were in the wood from the tree itself usually resist most of the water damage. It's just the UV protection, the weather protection. I would have to say you pretty much get what you pay for on those units. If you find the cheapest kit out there, is probably going to last the least amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks very much.
All right,
thank you.
Thank you
for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me take a second here because I know that you said that you really like to suggest to people that for anybody, if you're thinking about replacing your air conditioner for your house, for central air, now's the time to get in line.
Well, actually, I was going to bring up the fact that a lot of people are not thinking about changing their air conditioner and should be. In the last few years, and I know Hank's brought this up on previous editions of Focus 580 here, mm-hmm. that we're getting much more efficient with the air conditioners. Right now, I do believe the max or the minimum SEER rating, S-E-E-R, or seasonal energy efficiency rating, that is allowed to be sold right now is a 13. Any unit that is probably more than 10 or 12 years old has a SEER rating of somewhere around 6. Well, this SEER rating or this number is an actual BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. So if you replace a 6 SEER unit with a 13, you literally cut your energy usage in half. And with, of course, our rising energy prices and our new energy rates, and they're going to go up again for summer too, I'm sure, if you've got an older unit, 10 or 12 years old, even though it's functioning, if you use it much at all, you may be miles ahead to go ahead and get a new one. Now, as weather warms up, we had last week's little warm flash, and yes, my air conditioner came on in the truck, so I know I had to start thinking about it. Your heating and cooling guys are going to start booking up. So if you've got an old unit, and even though it worked last year, with the energy prices going up, you may want to start shopping around to see, hey, can you get another one? What kind of price range? And get on somebody's schedule. Otherwise, you may go into the beginning of the heating season a little unprepared.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, other calls are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of people here ready to go. Champaign County next, line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a question about... Well, I have an ice dam problem, and we haven't had the weather where it really has showed up very much until this year. But there's some damage on the part of the roof. It's below a sort of an inset window, so I can actually fix it without, you know, bothering much of the rest of the roof. But coincidentally, I'm planning on putting in a new race for my duct. I'm in an older house that actually didn't have central heating, so the ducts are, like, glommed here and there, and I'm going to consolidate them through the space. And I'm thinking about wasting some heat in some way into that soffit to prevent the ice damming. Does that just offhand sound reasonable, or what? I know I need to put a membrane underneath the new roofing material so the ice dam doesn't, you know, push the water back up in underneath the shingles, which is what it's done and how it's damaged it. But, I know in north of here they put like heating elements in and turn them on when they need them to get rid of ice dams and stuff. It's not something we really need to dwell on, particularly with global warming, but I'd like to save my roof so maybe when solar shingles are cheaper, I can do that instead of re-roofing the whole thing.
Right. Well, you're actually correct that we have not had the weather to bring ice damming around. This year we did have. We had several days of below zero weather. We ended up with quite a bit of snow buildup. And then we had a little bit of warming, but not enough to, it was the heat loss through the roof melted some of the snow. Basically, ice damming is just that. The roof areas over the living space get the snow on the roof. The snow then melts, and the water starts running down the shingles. Then you get to the overhang areas, and the water that is melting or running down under the snow refreezes because we don't have a heat source underneath it. And that starts building up a dam of ice, which the water can back up. If you have a low-pitch roof, a low-slope roof, it doesn't take a lot of water for that water to get high enough to be able to wick back behind the shingles and into the soffit areas. Putting heat into a soffit, yes, that will do it, but when you do it with your central air conditioning system, it's one of those things where it happens all the time, and so you're wasting heat on days when you don't have an ice dam possibility. The common repair for that, first of all, is, as you indicated, a membrane. When you do the roofing, you put down a modified bituminous roofing or a self-adhesive roofing membrane, usually 36 inches wide to cover the soffit areas. If you've got a big overhang, you may need to overlap that and make it a little bit wider. And then you install your shingles over the top of it, and that gives you a kind of a self-sealing membrane that is water-resistant, so any water that does get underneath the shingles will go ahead and come off the end. If you've got an area where you can't do something like that or you have a roof that you're not ready to do that to, they do make heating cables that can be applied to the shingles that are much like heat tape that we would use for water lines, and you'd only turn them on times when there was actually snow on the roof, so therefore we're not trying to waste energy the entire winter, or in the case here, we haven't had much ice damming in almost 6 or 7 years. My phone at the inspection service rings off the hook as soon as we get this type of condition because all of a sudden people are getting water where they've never had water before or never recall having water before. And it has been 6 or 7 years since we've had that issue. I believe it was 98, so 9 years ago was the last time that I ran into this. But a couple weeks ago, yes, I had some ice damming problems.
Well, I have a steep pitch roof, but just the peculiarity of the structure, I've got a valley there and somehow the water does wick up, and I do have the problem. And I the heat tape is something you apply on externally? I mean,
yeah, they've got some different heating style cables that actually go lay on top of the shingles. and attached to the shingles, and then you plug it in or have it on a thermostat so it comes on at certain temperatures to thaw things out.
Right. Well, it's a combination of things that you say. So just the temperature wouldn't be wouldn't indicate. I gather.
It sounds to me like you might have an issue. You say it's valley, and that's probably where it is, because your valley material may have either not been laid correctly or had a tear or a hole that's gotten into the valley that's allowing that water into.
No, there's good shit. There's good. What are the metal flashing is in the valley, so I really don't think that's it.
Well, the problem with metal flashings is when you put shingles up to them, you've got to drive a nail through it, so you do end up with holes in your metal flashing.
Maybe a combination of things as usual.
Yeah, there's no one easy answer for any of that. Like I said, probably the best deal is the self-adhesive roofing membranes underneath your flashing so that when your nails and stuff go through there, it does seal around it. And gives you a water barrier.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. Let's continue. Go next to someone in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
My question is about a hot water heater. Do you think it's a good idea to put an insulation blanket around the hot water heater?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. That was something that became very popular in the early 80s, late 70s, when we had our big energy crunch. Since then, the manufacturers of the water heaters have actually gotten much better at it, and the units that you purchase have adequate amounts of insulation around them for the most part. Doing inspections, I actually find that in vacant houses, the pilot light is enough to heat the water hotter than what the setting is on the thermostat for the water heater, just because of the amount of insulation in there. A lot depends on where it's at. If you've got it sitting in a garage that's not heated.
No, it's in the basement.
If it's in the basement, I do not think you need to do anything with it because the heat loss from it, they've got a pretty good insulation around it. You're not losing a lot of heat because it's not sitting in a cold area. So, no, I would not feel that would be.
It's probably maybe 10 or 20 years old.
Okay, well, obviously that must mean it's in Champaign City because...
I'm in Urbana.
Yeah, Champaign-Urbana, because anything in a rural area, the water heaters don't usually last that long. But in Champaign-Urbana, I have found them 30, 40 years old and still working quite well. Since it's in a basement, no, I don't think you're going to see enough increase in energy savings to make it worth putting the blanket on. The biggest problem I find with the blanket is too many people get them too close to the flue and they actually inhibit the airflow to the draft diverter. So it's an awful lot of times where I'm peeling them back after I find them just to make sure we're getting enough air through the draft diverter to ensure proper drafting of the unit.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We'll go on to another Urbana person. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd like to know about the advantages and disadvantages of concrete fiber siding.
Okay, advantages. It lasts practically forever. Disadvantage of it, it's brittle. If it gets hit with the child playing baseball or the rock from the lawnmower, you will crack and break it. But it is a very durable material. It doesn't have the expansion and contraction that vinyl siding does, so you can get things sealed up a little bit tighter. At the moment, there's a couple different thicknesses and brands, but I haven't found any that I would consider to be a real issue. It was played with quite a bit back in the 50s, only they called it cement asbestos shingles at that point in time. They used instead of a fiberglass fiber for reinforcement on the concrete, they used asbestos. And still today, I mean, we're talking 50, 60 years ago, and still today, I find one every couple of weeks, a rural property or something, that still has those cement asbestos shingles on it. They last forever.
Good, good. So, is it possible to get them painted at the factory?
That I'm not sure of. That I haven't gone into it far enough to find out if they have a special coating that they put on it. I know that they are paintable, but I don't know what the factories are offering.
Okay, thank you much.
All right, then back to St. Joe, line number one. Hello.
Hi. A minute ago you were talking about replacing air conditioning units 10 years or older because of higher efficiency now. I guess that also applies to heat pumps?
The heat pumps, yes, it can apply to those because the technology has just gotten a lot better as being more efficient for getting the heating or cooling out. Heat pump is effectively an air conditioner that runs backwards for the wintertime as opposed to the summertime. It would kind of depend on what the efficiency rating of the unit you've got. I mean, if 10 or 12 years ago you bought the top-of-the-line, most efficient one, then you're probably all right for right now. But if you opted for a little bit lesser unit at that particular point in time, it's probably way energy wasting at this point. Is it to the point where you might want to consider a new one?
Well, I think we got the top of the line in 22 years ago. And then when you said something about it's 10 years old, and I thought, oh, my gosh, it probably applies to our heat pump. And we were looking at heat pumps just getting ready to replace it in case it goes and so forth. And we're seeing that we can get them with a SEER rating of 19, which they're very, very good. But looking at the literature for my current heat pump, I couldn't find anything regarding a SEER rating. Maybe in 22 years ago they didn't have SEER ratings.
That's it exactly. That's something that they came up with as the heating and cooling technology came about. They came up with a rating to be able to qualify so we can know, hey, how much more energy efficient is this unit versus another unit.
So there's really no effective way for us to determine possible savings by buying or investing in a new system, huh?
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say if it's been there for 22 years, you're probably in the 6 to 7 SEER rating.
Oh, really?
Okay. Just from the technology of that particular time point. And while I'd indicated earlier that the minimum you can buy is a 13, you are absolutely correct. You are available. There are 18 or 19 SEER rating units out there available, which are very good as far as energy efficiency, but at this point, you know, as the prices are going up, they're getting more and more attractive. But I don't know if at this point you want to get an 18 or a 19 because they're so much more costly to install to begin with. And in another 8 to 10 years, that may be obsolete again, depending on how technology works.
So there's no way to determine a possible approximate savings by investing in a new pump?
Not that I'm aware of right off the top of my head. You'd have to figure out what the wattage usage of the unit you've got now and compare it to the literature for the new units to actually determine how much you're going to save, whether or not we're going to save 50% or whether we're going to save 35%. Is your unit got an electric backup heat as well?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the electric backup heat is pretty much going to be the same because electric backup heat is 100% efficient. So you're every bit of heat you put in the house. So where the savings is going to be on the days when it's above 25 degrees, although some of these new units, they claim they can pull heat down to 15 or 20 degrees. 20 degrees outside, there's not a whole lot of heat to draw back into the house, but they're actually being able to get some of it with the newer, high-efficiency units. But it's going to be increase the days when you're not on your backup system. It's going to increase the energy efficiency.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Well, that really it raises a question about if you were thinking about replacing your air conditioner, your central air unit, or maybe you're thinking about replacing a furnace, do you spend the money to get the most efficient model that you can, which is obviously going to be expensive, or do you maybe back down just a little bit, get one that's not that is no doubt more efficient than what you already have, but not the absolute maximum. Save yourself a little money. I mean, how do you decide what the payback's going to be? How long is it going to take? And whether it pays you to go for the best possible furnace or air conditioning unit you can get?
Well, I'm going to have to say that's a real tough call to go one way or another. I'm a fairly practical mechanical type person, and I like to figure that the very most expensive is not necessarily the best way to go because they're usually the cutting edge of technology and will have A, the most problems, and B, are the first ones that the price drop down. It's sort of like going out there and buying the most expensive computer you can buy, and next year you find out that it's average compared to what is available the very next year. Mm-hmm. So I wait for the prices to come down and get into the mid-range. Right now, 13 is the minimum. So when I'm pricing out air conditioners at the moment, I'm looking in the 14 to 15 range, figuring that value-wise, that is a good buy. We're doubling what we had before. If we had a 6 and we go to a 13, we're more than doubling our energy efficiency. But when you go from a 13 to an 18, we're not doubling it. We're only getting another 25 or 30%. So going to the very high price units, unless it's a totally new construction, the brand new house, big, huge house where you've got a lot of need for cooling and heating, I don't know that the top of the line is what you need to go with. I also like the tried and true. If I've got one that's a 15 SEER, it's one that's been out for a couple of years. We know which ones are working, which ones aren't. Whereas the brand new highest efficiency, same thing, like even in stereo equipment, you know, you get the very high-end stereo equipment, it costs quite a bit. I remember when CDs first came out, boy, you could buy a unit for $1,200. Now you can buy one for, well, I won't say 12, but you can probably get one for 60 or 50 or $60. So, I don't know that the super high efficiency is the way to go unless you're doing just new construction, really large house. It's the energy savings is something you're going to see over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Also, a little bit depends on how long you're going to own the house. If you're going to stay in the house for 4 or 5 years, no, I would not put in an 18 or a 19 SEER. If you're going to stay in the house for 35 years, well, there's a little bit more consideration to be given to the higher end.
Okay. Well, let's talk with somebody else. Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know if you had any thoughts on these tankless water heaters. There was an article in the News Gazette, I think it was Friday or Thursday, about solar panels for homes, and then there was a story about a tankless water heater. If you knew about that, what are your thoughts, and do they sell them in this area?
Tankless water heaters are something that come around, and yes, I am familiar with them. I'm not familiar with the article in the Gazette. I guess I should have picked up on that. First of all, you mentioned solar, and there was some research done here at the University of Illinois back in the 80s that I think my father was actually part of that indicated that our solar gain here is not as much as it is in, say, high altitudes or sunny California. So the solar is not as attractive economically here as it would be in other areas. The tankless water heaters have a definite niche or definite purpose. Kind of depends on your lifestyle. If right now, as I indicated with an earlier caller, some of the water heaters that are out there now have enough insulation and the pilot light is enough. Let's say you've got it set to keep your water in there at 125 or 120 degrees. The pilot light is enough to keep that at temperature when you're not using the house. I've gone into vacant houses and the temperature was actually 130, 140 when the thermostat was set at 125. So the pilot light was actually putting off enough heat to warm the water higher than what the setting is.
Okay.
So if you've got a good water heater and you use your water on a regular basis, say a family of 3 or 4, then I don't think the tankless, the instant on, instant off, is going to save you anything.
Mm-hmm.
Where the instant on, instant off saves is if you have very low water usage, I would say for a summer house, a vacation house, something like that, yes. It actually works fairly well here. We have some building going on in Colorado, and the tankless don't work as well because the water coming out of the ground is so much colder, and the tankless is good for bringing it up, say, X number of degrees. But if the water coming in is quite cold, X number of degrees is not going to be as warm.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you start in Florida and the water comes out fairly warm, you can get it up to hot water fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things. In the wintertime, it's not going to be as warm as it would be in the summertime or as energy savings. You'd have to set it up higher in the wintertime.
Okay, well, my problem is I have a ranch-style house, and uh-huh. I'm remodeling a bathroom on one end of the house, and the water heater is on the opposite end of this long rectangle, if you can imagine, and the water heater sits near the garage. You know, it's all on one level. It's not in a basement or anything like that. And so I was told to get a 50-gallon water heater because by the time the water reaches this new bathroom I'm putting in, sometimes it's kind of, you know, warm. You know, I got to let the water run a long time for it to heat up. And I was told if I got a larger water heater that would help solve the problem. And I read this article about tankless, and I thought maybe that might be the way to go.
Generally speaking, most of the tankless are still relatively, I'm going to say, expensive relative to a gas unit.
Right.
What that particular application would be, I would put in, if you were to do it, you would put a small tankless unit near the bathroom and still plumb it through the hot water so that it wouldn't have to operate, it wouldn't have to do most of the heating, it would just be heating the initial water supply.
Right.
You're going to, unless your water lines run through the slab or run through an uninsulated area, eventually you will get hot water, and that hot water will be quite adequate from the gas. But you're right, you're going to have to open the faucet and let the hot water run for 30 seconds to a minute to get the warm water all the way to the unit, mm-hmm. to the particular fixture.
Yeah, and I was thinking I was wasting water that way. You know, maybe that's why I was just curious about this.
And a tankless would work for that, but it would be I'm going to say not the most economical solution to it.
Okay.
There's another solution, and that would be to put in a return loop. And that's where they run a pipe from the farthest fixture in the house, farthest away from the water heater, back to the water heater, and they put a circulating pump on it or even a gravity system. And you insulate your warm water pipes so you don't have a lot of heat loss. But this system will actually keep warm water or hot water to that fixture at all times.
Oh, okay.
Because it will drain back to the water heater.
Okay, and you say it's a return loop?
Yeah, a recirculating loop.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, very good. Hope that helps. This morning here in the Sparta Focus 580, we're doing our monthly show on home maintenance. You have a problem, you need some advice. Our guest, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service, will do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next, someone else in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
You could help me with this, maybe, Dave. I'm calling because this one man called earlier when Ed Kieser was on about tornado preparedness and mm-hmm. asked something. He was concerned about the bathtub and how safe it would be if he and family got in the bathtub as part of safety for a tornado, and maybe there was a thunderstorm there too, about electrical shielding of this tub. It was a certain kind of tub.
We'll see what Scott says. We were indeed the other day, last week, we were doing a show with Ed and talking about tornado preparedness.
Mm-hmm.
And someone called in and asked this question. And because, you know, sometimes the advice is that one of the safest places in the house, and usually because it's in the center and there you're supposed to put as many walls between you and the tornado, often the safest place is the bathroom. And sometimes the advice we've been given is because you want to prevent being hit by flying stuff, that it's maybe the safest thing to do is to actually get into the bathtub and then find something to cover yourself with. So caller calls in and says, well, I have a cast iron bathtub. Now, of course, we've all been told if there's a lightning storm going on outside, you don't want to be taking a shower right then. And particularly, I think if you had an iron bathtub, you probably wouldn't want to do that. But his question was, well, okay, so what about that? Would it be a bad idea if you had a cast iron bathtub to be in there if there was lightning going on?
Okay, well, this is going to be one of those things. It's sort of like winning the lottery. I'm not going to be able to predict every particular case, so I'm going to go and say that most people are not going to win the lottery. I'm going to say in most cases that's not going to be an issue, because as soon as it does enough damage to where it's actually destroying the house, one of the first things it goes is the power pole, which supplies the power to the house. So the house is going to be without power very quickly. So the possibility of electrical in the tub in a house without power, pretty slim. Mm-hmm. So I would say the cast iron tub is not a problem. And with the tornado preparedness, my feelings on this is that, yes, you want to be closer to the center of the house. You want to be someplace where there's little or no glass, because flying debris actually does most of the damage. But also watching tornado tapes, Weather Channel has their worst storms and what have you. It's absolutely amazing at the number of total devastation areas that leave the cars on the concrete slab in the garage. What happens is that tornado is basically exploding the house. It's a low-pressure area. Everything tends to fly out. One of the places that I've considered to be one of the safest, I won't say it's been approved by everybody, but watching tapes and stuff, it's a pretty safe bet. In the car, in the garage. They tell you never to be in your car outside, and that's correct. If you have to be in your car, you want to be in a ditch or you want to get as low as possible. But in your car, in the garage, you're surrounded with steel and safety glass. There's nothing in that house that can actually crush the car The steel is strong enough where that wouldn't be a problem. You would take a sleeping bag or a blanket or something, put over your head. The safety glass is not going to be shards where it's going to be decapitating portions of your body. You might get some scrapes and scratches. But an inner wall room, such as a bathroom with no windows, in the car, in the garage, something like that, some place where you're protected and there's very minimal exposure to the outside is where you want to be. So hopefully that'll answer that.
Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Also, of course, I think one of the things we also mentioned in that piece of standard advice is you want to go to the lowest floor possible. So probably for a lot of people, if you have a basement, that's the place that you want to be, provided also that you're under something, some sturdy structure. If there's a staircase, maybe that's the place to be.
Yes.
If you have a heavy table or a workbench, maybe that's the place to be. Again, what you want to do is you want to protect yourself from any debris that's going to be flying around or that might fall on top of you.
Right.
All right. Let's continue. Piatt County is next. Line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've asked several people for advice, so I just thought I'd ask you for advice, too. We bought an old barn on some property and have thought about fixing it up. And everybody who comes out has such a different opinion of, that's a good idea. No, that's not a good idea. It's on a slab, and then the barn itself is on about 4 deep concrete blocks. And there doesn't look to be a lot of cracks or things like that, so we didn't even think about worrying about the foundation until somebody said, you need at least 3 feet of concrete there. So when you put wallboard and things up and your other siding, it won't sag from the weight. And so we dug down and have about 2 feet of concrete on one side and 1 foot of concrete on the other side. But, of course, we only dug one place, and we didn't dig all along the edge or have it professionally dug out. So I'm just wondering, is that a concern that you should have 3 feet of concrete for a slab?
Well, if we're going to build a home, we want to get down below the frost line down to solid soil, and so they actually require, I believe it's at least a minimum of 32-inch depth for a footing. I don't believe the same is true for agricultural buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often we find what they call a 1-inch or rat wall if it's put on a slab, or not 1-inch, 1 foot.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got 1 to 2 feet, it should be sufficient. The problem is you can get a little bit of soil movement either from moisture or from frost heave if you don't get it deep enough to where things can move. Most barns aren't finished on the inside, so we don't have to worry about a little movement. You mm-hmm. don't get drywall cracks and such like you do on a house because we don't have drywall. Most barns actually are post and beam style and not necessarily mounted on a slab. You're sure this thing's sitting on
a slab, and it's not post and beam. It's just a stick construction.
So it's a sill plate on a slab.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say it's not going to move, but I don't think you're going to start sinking into the ground by putting a little bit more weight on it, no.
Yeah, okay. Are there ways that they can supplement the foundation? A contractor can do that after the fact, or is that...
If something happens or something moves, yes, there are ways to do that. What they can do is they can dig down next to the footing. They then drill into the footing and put in some rebar, pour a new... effectively a concrete sidewalk or a partial mm-hmm. footing outside of the original.
Mm-hmm.
And after everything sets up in 6 to 8 weeks, they can mud jack or hydraulically lift the new slab back up, which then pulls the old one up with it and re-levels things. It's a process called mud jacking.
Okay. Well, that sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. So thank you so much for your opinion.
All right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Bye. Back here to someone in Urbana. This is line number 2. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This morning, while it was raining hard, I was watching little drops fall from between the sheathing and my roof from inside the attic, and I'm trying to figure out where that's coming from. The only structure above, I know it's usually flashing problems, the only structure above that is an air vent, one of these turbine vents, and I look around that, and I don't see any evidence of water coming through there. So I was wondering if you might have some ideas of how to figure this out, where the water might be coming in from.
Well, that's going to be a tough one without actually seeing it because water leaks in an attic are, how should I put this, a little bit tricky to try and figure out because that water can move in all different directions. Where you're getting the water coming out may be 10, 12 feet away from where the water's coming in. We look for valley areas. We look for flashing areas. We did have an awful hard rain this morning. I know I was out there bright and early at 7 o'clock cleaning out my gutters because they were overflowing. So yeah. I know it was raining pretty good.
Yeah. But the water has to flow. I mean, it can't flow uphill.
Well, I won't say that. Water, it won't flow uphill, but capillary attraction can draw it uphill. Water will work its way up if it gets underneath a shingle, depending on the pitch of things. Generally speaking, if you've got a 412 or better pitch roof, then no, it's not going to go uphill. But it will go laterally quite a ways, or it can be quite a ways farther up and running down a sheet and just happens to come out in between two sheets. So it's tricky to find out. Most of the time, you're not going to get leakage on a flat surface. So, yes, we do look first at penetrations, wall penetrations, plumbing penetrations, vent penetrations, anything that happens to go through the roof. The next place to look for would be valleys. Water going down a valley can find a way in and then work its way horizontally across the board 8 feet or so before it comes out.
Yeah. Well, there's no valleys. It's not a real steep in front of the house. It's like a one-and-a-half story. I did notice that some of the shingles have a little bit of curl on them at the end, and the water does stay there a little bit. I don't know, could that possibly be a problem? It's not a lot of water, but just like a tablespoonful at the end of some of the shingles.
Is this a roof that is below, say, a wall from an upper level or something?
No.
Okay. Because quite often we'll get water in behind the siding on a upper level that comes out on a lower level roof.
No, it's a top level.
Okay. Boy, that's going to be tricky without actually coming out and physically seeing where it could come from.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, I couldn't help on that one.
Okay,
all right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Let's go on here to somebody on a cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I'm on the road in Illinois. I was here visiting family, and I'm heading back to Michigan. I just bought a home a few months back. I'm a first-time homeowner, and I know very little about homes and especially roofs. When I had an inspection done in October, I was told that I need a new roof. I've put it off these few months very nervously, and I'm at the point now where I've gathered several estimates from different roofing contractors. My question is, how do I go about selecting a roofing contractor, given that I know very little about roofs? And also, the estimates seem to vary quite widely. I have an estimate for $8,000, and I also have an estimate for about $2,500. I would like your advice on how I go about finding a roofing contractor, and what are some things that I absolutely need to look for in the estimate or in the kind of contractor I decide to go with.
Okay, being in an area you're unfamiliar with, that is often a difficult thing to do, is to find somebody of a reputable quality. Since you're fairly new to the area and just bought the house, one of the things I would do is check with your realtor. Realtors oftentimes deal with contractors on things like that because they run across so many houses as they're being sold that need a roof or need repairs. And so usually the realtors are a pretty good source for somebody that can do that work. When it comes to roofing, I usually tend to throw out the high bid and the low bid. Usually there's a reason for one or the other. It's a little bit lesser of a job if they're not putting in new edge metals or not putting in new drip edge, if they're going to tar around flashing boots. So you want to make sure that they're getting a new drip edge on there, a new rake edge, make sure they're putting new plumbing boots, make sure that they're reflashing to a brick chimney rather than sealing with a roofing tar. The cheap bids are usually the guys that throw the shingles up there and then have a whole bunch of tubes of caulk or blackjack, as they call it, and seal everything back up. And in my opinion, a new roof should never have any sealant on it exposed. Everything should be properly flashed and not have to have this patching compound installed. The high-end roof, usually they're trying to sell you a 35-year-plus shingle, which...
Yeah.
Most of the time we don't find last about 25 years like the rest of the shingles, depending on how the weather goes. And that 35-year warranty is void if it's a second layer of shingles. And it is a prorated, so if it only makes it 20 years and they figure they owe you half the price of what it costs for the shingles, which are the actual cheapest portion of the entire roofing job. So, like I say, I usually try and stay away from the high one. I try and stay away from the low one and work with your realtor. And that's often a really good source of who does a decent job.
Okay. Would you also be able to recommend a book or something that I could read, perhaps to get a little bit more information about roofs and things like that?
Well, I don't have a single source for that, no. There's so many different types of roofing that there's no one book out there saying how to buy a roof. Usually what I look for is a good quality shingle if you're using a shingle roof. You get up into Michigan, they got several different roofing materials. I see an awful lot of steel roofs up there, and they also have some heavy weather shingles, which are not a bad idea because they do have a little bit more cold and a little bit more wind than what we see around here in some areas. Try and find something that's got a 20 to 25-year rating. Stay away from the 15-year ratings, and I'd try and stay away from the 35-year ratings. There are some other materials that can be used, but generally you get into the plastics and the steels and stuff, and your price of your roof goes up. So the asphalt is probably the most economical in the long run.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We'll try real quick to get in one more caller here. Chicago, line 4. You have to be quick, though, please.
Well, I've got a question. It's a long one. I'm in a 200-unit building, 30 years old, with radiant heat. What percent of the heat is from the floor and from the ceiling?
Depends on where the radiant heat's located. Depends whether or not they've got the radiant ceiling cables or whether they're using a radiant heat to heat the slab. I don't know without...
Well, the floor is heated and the ceiling above, but everybody says their heat is coming from the floor. It's hot water, I guess.
Well, a hot water in a slab is an efficient way of doing it because that slab does kind of warm up and ends up radiating towards you. But a radiant heat in the ceiling also works because your body will tend to absorb that heat from around it. I have no good way of calculating the percentages ceiling to floor on that type of unit.
I'm going to have to jump in here. I'm sorry to have to apologize to the caller, but we're just at the end of the time. We're going to have to stop. We'll do it again a month from now. Scott will be back.
So I will be back.
Scott Spies, he's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do these shows once a month here on AM 580 on Focus to give you a chance to ask these questions.